Amen. You may be seated. Well, as you can see, if you look at the bulletin, I've titled this sermon, Take It From Me. Take It From Me, The Royal Inscription of the King East of Eden. Well, last week, as we started this sermon series, we got a lay of the landscape of this strange and challenging book by identifying four key landmarks. We went over those four key landmarks as we navigate the landscape of this book. First of all, we saw the main declaration. Look at 1 verse 2 with me. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. We saw the central question, verse 3. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? We saw the fixed location that is under the sun. It's this fallen world in which we all live. We also saw the audience, all of humanity. This isn't just Israel in view here. This is all of humanity that the preacher is even metaphorically preaching to. We also saw how we're to learn from nature that under the sun, there is nothing new and there is nothing remembered. Now, we ended by noticing that, however, as true as this is, the God-man Jesus Christ has, in fact, gained something new. And he will be remembered because he has overcome death in the grave. So he has gained something new under the sun. He has even brought in, he has guaranteed a new creation. The new creation has been inaugurated and yet not consummated at this point, but he has guaranteed it by his resurrection. And so he has gained something new, and he will be remembered. But as we return now to verse 12 of chapter 1, we return to the book itself, we can see where the preacher is driving us now. This is what we're going to see. And we can see that he actually left us hanging at the end of last Sunday. Let's look at verses 10 and 11 again, chapter 1. He said, is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. So we saw last time that the preacher's boldness and exhaustive statements here are by design. His boldness is meant to elicit a response. And that response is, yeah, but. But what about this? Just hold on a second. Wait. Well, as we saw, it is incumbent upon us to actually keep our mouths shut at this point and instead sit at the preacher's feet and listen to him in order for us to grow in wisdom. Proverbs 10:17 says, whoever heeds instruction is on the path to life, but he who rejects reproof leads others astray. So we want to continue this morning then to hear what the preacher has to say. And one of the things we're going to see now as we come back to his bold statements is we're going to see how he came to his conclusions. And what we're going to see is this is all actually based on personal experience. He's basically saying, been there, done that. Take it from me. Now, let's maybe allow ourselves just a few objections at this point. They could be something like this. Why should we take it from you? Why should we take it from you? What makes you so special? Why should we trust you? Well, look at verse 12 with me. Ecclesiastes 1, verse 12. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. Okay. So this isn't just an ordinary dude. It's just not a random guy off the street. Have you been king over Jerusalem? I haven't. So maybe let's hear him out here. We've already seen this from 1:1. He said that he's the son of David, king in Jerusalem. But what we see now is the preacher, he's identifying as the king. He was the king over Jerusalem. And what he's doing is he's using a well-known genre here now in the ancient Near East called the royal inscription. That's why I have titled this sermon, The Royal Inscription of the King East of Eden. What was a royal inscription in the ancient Near East? Well, the royal inscription of the king was the inscripturation, or the scripting, the scribing, the writing down of the great works and exploits and legacy of the king. So, for example, you can Google the royal inscriptions of Nabopolassar and Nebuchadnezzar, kings of Babylon. And in these royal inscriptions of Nebuchadnezzar, of course, you would find what we would expect to find. He speaks of all of his exploits, including his exploits over the people of Judah, right? The destruction of the temple, the destruction of Jerusalem, and even the Babylonian captivity, right? So the king, basically, in the royal inscription, he's bragging about all of his exploits, about all of his power and supremacy. And that was the basic genre of this royal inscription. That was the emphasis that you find. Now, if you think about it, a modern-day example could be, if you consider Donald Trump, he is sort of like a walking, talking royal inscription, isn't he? He's constantly talking about all this amazing stuff that he's going to do and has done, right? He's talking about his supremacy and his power and his exploits. And the funny thing is he's still alive, right? He's like a walking, talking royal inscription. So you sort of get a modern-day example there. But so with that in mind then, how does this king begin his royal inscription? Well, what we see here in verses 12 to 18 are three components which happen twice. Three components which happen twice. Let's walk through this. First, there's an explanation of his quest. Second, the conclusion he came to. And third, a proverb which further explains his conclusion. So I'm in the king's quest here, if you're tracking in the bulletin. Let's look at 12 to 15. He said, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I've seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after winds. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. So what was the king's quest? Well, you see it there in verse 13. I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. So under heaven here is synonymous with under the sun. We've already seen that. What's his conclusion? It is an unhappy business that God has given the children of man to be busy with. All of it is vanity and a striving after the wind. So just ask yourself, have you ever tried to harness the wind? Have you ever tried to catch it and contain it? That's, of course, an exercise in futility. So what's the proverb then, which reinforces or sort of buttresses his conclusion? Verse 15, what is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. Now, I don't know about you, but for a royal inscription, put it this way, if this guy is running in a democratic country, he is not getting elected, right? He's not getting elected. He's supposed to say, I have acquired great wisdom, and I know how to make everybody happy. I'm going to fix everything that has been broken, and there will be nothing lacking. Right? That's what the king is supposed to say. That's certainly what the politician is supposed to say. Okay, well, let's maybe give him a break here. Maybe he's learning how to campaign. Maybe he's just learning. He needs help from his PR team. This almost sounds a little bit like that now infamous debate last summer, I believe it was, between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, where it became very apparent to everybody that Joe Biden was in fact suffering from dementia. You might remember that. You might even recall that clip of his campaign managers wincing and grimacing as he performed poorly. Is that what the king is doing here? Is he just performing poorly? What's going on here? Maybe he just needs to improve his public relations. Okay, what does he say the second time around then? I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. Okay, this sounds hopeful. This sounds good. He's pretty smart. Can you guys say that your wisdom has surpassed all before you? This seems promising. How does he carry on? Verses 17 and 18. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is but a striving after winds. For much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Well, as you might be able to see by now, this is something the commentator Barry Webb has pointed out. There's a rather ironic and strange twist to the royal inscription from the king taking place here. This is what we need to see. No, he doesn't have dementia, and he's actually not too worried about maintaining good PR. What we have here is a surprising example of humility and brutal honesty that you would not expect from a man in his position. That's what we see here. You guys tracking? That's the king's quest. So let's keep listening now as he continues sharing his quest. This is limitless pleasure and wisdom east of Eden. 2:1 to 11. Look with me at 2:1 to 3. He said, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad. And of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine. My heart still guided me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. Look with me now at verse 8. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the sons of man. Well, what we see here then is the king had unlimited access to what we could call the pleasures of wine, women, and music. As king, he was in the unique position to get whatever his heart desired. He could snap his fingers, and it was his. The best wine, never running out. Concubines at his disposal, whenever he desired. And music on demand. You got to remember, in the ancient world, you couldn't just flick on the radio or pop music into your earbuds. If there is music, you had to be able to afford professional singers. And he had professional singers, plural, both men and women. He had music in his palace on demand, whenever he wanted. This would have been a supreme luxury in the ancient world. And of course, the musicians sounded good. So he enjoyed then, in other words, the pleasures of wine, women, and music. Needless to say then, none of us here will ever experience what this man experienced, right? We'll never experience what he experienced. We have to take his word for it. He also enjoyed the pleasures of wealth and productivity. Look with me at 2:4 to 8. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I also had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. So in other words, if he wanted to make it, he could build it. Right? He had the means. He had the ability. Affordability was not an issue. There were no constraints. So again, this man was in an extremely unique position of being able to do it all and experience it all. It was all at his power and disposal. You see that there? But there are clues here. We need to dig a little bit deeper. There are clues here that we needn't miss. It's something that is very remarkable and unique. What do I mean by that? Well, in the ancient world, and even in our day, you consider the billionaires of our day, there have been many kings throughout the ages that have had at their disposal the pleasures of wine, women, and music, the pleasures of wealth and productivity. You could, again, think of some of the billionaires in our day. So it's a unique experience. It's a unique position, but not utterly unique. What is it that made this king utterly unique? What else did he have at his disposal? He had the greatest wisdom the world has ever seen. You see that? He had the greatest wisdom the world had ever seen. Look at 1:16 again. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. He reiterates this in 2 verse 9. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. So this king then, in his experiences, not only of pleasure and productivity, his experiences of great wisdom were utterly unique. You want to read a book written by the smartest man in the world? It's right here. It's right here. Let's just consider at this point then, I think it's helpful to consider, for us to consider some of the language that is used to describe King Solomon concerning his wisdom. Many of you will know, when the Lord appeared to Solomon in 1 Kings 3, the Lord told him to ask whatever he wished. And rather than asking for wealth and riches, he asked for wisdom. And the Lord was pleased with that request, and he granted it to him. This is 1 Kings 3, 12 and 13. Behold, this is the Lord to Solomon. Behold, I now do according to your word. Behold, I give you a wise and discerning mind. Notice this. So that none like you has been before you, and none like you shall arise after you. That's unique. I give you also what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that no other king shall compare with you all your days. That sounds a whole lot like the description of the king in Ecclesiastes to me. I bring this up because part of the challenge with this book is what I found is some even conservative evangelical commentators will suggest that it could have been someone other than King Solomon because you don't find Solomon's name here. I think by design, it actually adds to the enigmatic and mysterious character of the book. It's actually by design. But I think if we put two and two together, I think it is King Solomon. I think it's King Solomon. One of the arguments that some commentators will bring up for it perhaps being not King Solomon is he says that he surpassed all who were before him, and only Saul and David came before him, right? There's only two kings. I think he's actually saying something more broad than that. He's saying king over Jerusalem. Solomon was king of the empire. He was king of kings. Let's look at this. This is 1 Kings 4:21. Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates to the land of the Philistines and to the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. So one of the things we need to see then from the Old Testament, the historical narratives of Solomon, is that he truly was the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords in his day. That's what Solomon was. 1 Kings 4:29 and 30. And God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding beyond measure and breadth of mind like the sand on the seashore, so that Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the people of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt. One more verse, 1 Kings 10:22 and 23. For the king had a fleet of ships of Tarshish at sea with the fleet of Hiram. Once every 3 years, the fleet of ships of Tarshish used to come bringing gold, silver, ivory, apes, and peacocks. And notice this, thus King Solomon excelled all the kings of the earth in riches and in wisdom. And the whole earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put into his mind. Now, one of the complicating factors, of course, is 1 Kings 11 tells us that Solomon later on in life turned away from the Lord, right? So this is one of the challenges, again, with trying to figure out the author of this book. I think, again, by God's design, if it is Solomon, he was severely humbled, and he shared his wisdom, and yet the Lord saw to it that the authorship of this book is left obscured. Nonetheless, I do think that it's helpful just to consider that it is Solomon that wrote the book. So when we consider then the limitless pleasures that this king enjoyed, we also need to recognize the limitless wisdom he had. So we could put it this way. If ever there was a royal inscription of royal inscriptions, this was it. This was it. The wisest king to ever live. If ever any king had supreme bragging rights, this was it. He had the ability for the ultimate mic drop as king, right? And what did he do? We could even put it this way. He had found the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. He had been on top of Everest. He had hoisted the Stanley Cup. He had walked on the moon. All of his investments had succeeded beyond his wildest imaginations. He had the dream house, the dream career, the dream wives. We know how many wives Solomon had, right? He had it all. And on top of that, he was the wisest man in the world. So what should we expect him to say then? Look at 2:9-11 now. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil. And this was my reward for all my toil. Notice this. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind. And there was nothing to be gained under the sun. Okay, so now we're starting to catch a picture now of how he could come to his conclusion in 1 verse 3. Remember the burden of the book, the burning question? Look at it again. 1 verse 3. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? That's the million-dollar question. He had experienced limitless pleasures and limitless wisdom east of Eden. What was the discovery of his quest? There was nothing to be gained under the sun. So you see, brothers and sisters, we need to take it from him. We need to take it from him, because you and I will never have the wealth nor the wisdom of this man. We need to take it from him. He's saying, been there, done that, take it from me. And the key to recognize here at this point is that he experienced limitless wisdom and limitless pleasures east of Eden. He was east of Eden. Remember what the Lord did in Eden at the end of Genesis 3. Turn with me there. Let's look at it together. After the Lord had cursed the serpent and Adam and Eve and the creation, what did he say? This is Genesis 3. Genesis 3, 22. Genesis 3:22, then the Lord God said, behold, the man has become like one of us in knowing good and evil. Now lest he reach out his hand and take also of the tree of life and eat and live forever. Now notice this, dot, 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 right? What's going on there? Notice now that this verse is left unfinished. Do you see that there? It's open-ended. God has stopped his thought mid-sentence here. And what we're supposed to recognize here, what we're supposed to do, is imagine what the world would be like, this fallen world, if sinners lived forever. That's what we're supposed to imagine here. Imagine living in a world where Hitler never died. Verse 23, therefore the Lord God sent him out from the Garden of Eden to work the ground from which he was taken. He drove out the man, and at the east of the Garden of Eden, he placed the cherubim and a flaming sword that turned every way to guard the way to the tree of life. Now to this day, all of humanity continues to live under the sun, or we could say east of Eden. We're all east of Eden. Now if you think about Genesis 2, and the work that God had given Adam and Eve to do, you'll recognize the parallels then to what Solomon was saying that he did in chapter 2 here, verses 4 and 5, right? He was making great works. He was planting vineyards and gardens. He was watering and keeping. These are all words that are used in Genesis 2 before the fall, to describe the paradise that Adam and Eve lived in. And the design was that Adam and Eve were to take dominion and expand the garden out and continue doing these things, planting and watering and guarding and keeping and tending, and to enjoy God forever. So the reason I bring this up then is we need to see this in chapter 2. What we see here with Solomon is that if there was ever a man on the face of the earth who would be able to bring us back to the garden, if there was ever a man, more precisely, who could create a new garden paradise where humanity would live forever, it was Solomon. It was him. And where did he end up? Well, it ended for him in bitter disappointment. Bitter disappointment. He couldn't do it. And again, we need to take it from him. If Solomon couldn't do it, you can't do it, and neither can I. Right? This is what we need to be getting here. So I just need to ask yourself then, are you trying to carve out for yourself a little piece of paradise in this world? Now, don't hear me wrong. It's a good thing to desire your own place, right? Your own home, your own yard, all that stuff. There's a reason why human beings like taking care of stuff like that. We were created to do that, right? But my point is, why do you think it is that everything in this world actually never quite satisfies or turns out the way that you desire it to? Why is that? Well, let the reader understand. What did Solomon's discoveries lead him to? This is point three, death and despair east of Eden. Look with me at 2:12 to 16. 2:12 to 16. He says, "So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king?" Again, take it from me, right? What can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has been done already. Only what has already been done. "Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly." So there's some temporary gain here. "As there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet," here's the key, "I perceive that the same event happens to them all," to all of them. "Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten." And here's the point: how the wise dies just like the fool. How the wise dies just like the fool. With all of his wealth, with all of his wisdom, even the wisest man in the world, with all of his pleasure and productivity and ingenuity, he could not create a paradise in order for humanity to escape death. Solomon himself would die just like the fool. This is what he found. Remember the Proverbs of 1:15 and 1:18. Look at them again. "What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted." Verse 18, "For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow." So the wise dies just like the fool, and there is no fixing this. God has made the creation crooked, and man cannot straighten it. The wiser he became, the more aware of this he became, and the more sorrowful he became. Look at 2:17. He said, "So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after winds." He was faced with the inescapable and overwhelming reality of his impending death east of Eden. And so he hated life. Now again, it needs to be pointed out that for how morbid and depressing perhaps this might seem, for a royal inscription from the king, this is actually remarkably honest and helpful for us. Do you see that there? Needless to say, you will search in vain to find another royal inscription like this, right? You read the royal inscriptions of the ancient Near East, and they're going to sound like Trump, right? You will search in vain to find one like this. This is wisdom from above. We're getting a full access view into the personal thought life of the wisest man in the world, and he has been telling us, you need to take it from me. You need to take it from me. You and I will never have the mind or the wealth or the experience of Solomon, so we need to learn from him. So with that reality in mind then, the reality of the grim reaper staring him down, what does he turn to then? He turns to despair. Look with me now at 2:18 to 23. Again, he says, I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be a wise or a fool? Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun. Because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. So he gives himself up to despair because of the impending reality of his coming death. Now, it's interesting. I've actually had multiple conversations with multiple folks in the church this past week who have told me that since I started this sermon series in Ecclesiastes, they've told me that this is actually one of their favorite books, which I've found very interesting. I wonder if, at least in part, this is because we're living in a time and an age where everybody is just expected to be happy all the time. We live in an age where everything is always fine. It's all good. We're good, right? You're good. I'm good. We're all good. Nothing wrong here. It's like the bumper sticker that you see sometimes. No bad days. You see that one? No bad days. With the palm tree? Well, needless to say, this is delusional. It doesn't correspond to reality. It doesn't match the human experience. There is much trouble in this world. There is sorrow, there is vexation, there is futility in work, there are sleepless nights. Things are not what they were meant to be, and we cannot fix it. So we need to be real about this. We are living and toiling and dying east of Eden. This is the world that we're living in. And so what are we to do then? Are we to feign perpetual happiness? Or maybe the flip side, are we to just be miserable wretches? Is that what we're supposed to do? Well, that's not the solution either. The king actually tells us here. This is simple and surprising satisfaction east of Eden. Look with me at verse 24. He says, there's nothing better for a person that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. Now, this is interesting to note. We just saw death and despair east of Eden. That's actually the logical place to land, I would argue, when faced with the reality of the vanity of life and your impending death. But notice who he mentions for the first time since verse 13 here. Who does he mention in verse 24? He mentions God. See that? He mentions God. So after verse 13, in other words, the king had gone on and on and on about how I did this and I did that and I applied my wisdom to find out. And in all of it, he had forgotten about God. He had forgotten about God. Now you might say, well, I'd rather forget about God too, because he's given us this unhappy business under the sun. Maybe I should just forget about him. Well, here's the key to understanding this, brothers and sisters. God has seen to it in this life east of Eden, that life remains ultimately unsatisfying under the sun, so that we are constantly reminded that we are yet east of Eden. We're not in paradise. We'd be fooling ourselves if we thought we were. And yet, what do we see in verses 24 to 26? God is still granting echoes of Eden, as it were, to those who remember him, to those who please him, to those who fear him. Let's look at the last verses now. There's nothing better for a person that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in all his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases God, him, God has given, that's the key verb here, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given, same verb, the business of gathering and collecting only to give to the one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. So in other words, in the midst of the ultimately unsatisfying life under the sun, God is still granting echoes of Eden that are surprisingly simple. They're simple and surprising. Enjoyment of eating and drinking and toiling. Enjoyment of these things in their proper places, not freighting with them with all the weight of perfect satisfaction, which you're not going to find in those things, right? Now, this might strike you at this point, and this is one of the things about Ecclesiastes, this might strike you as a little bit anticlimactic to end this chapter. You may be thinking, really? There's nothing better than that? There must be something better than that. Eating, drinking, toiling? Well, let's not miss the profound point that the king is making here. Again, you and I will never experience his wealth and wisdom. But do you eat? Do you drink? Do you toil? Yeah, we all do, right? By God's design, in this fallen world, we can still find, as he gives, he's the giver, as he gives, we can enjoy simple things that every human being under the sun can still enjoy who pleases God. Do you see that? So in other words, you don't need to be the king in Jerusalem. You don't need to be the wisest man in the world. You don't need to be the richest man in the world. You don't even need the dream house and the dream job and everything else. Because there is no such thing as those things anyways. You're going to find yourself toiling there. So we need to learn, in other words, how to enjoy the simple things in life as God gives us the ability to do so. Remember what James 1:17 tells us, he is the giver of all good things from above, right? That's a paraphrase. But God is the giver of all good things. But there is more here, and I close shortly. As New Covenant believers, we would be in error if we failed to read this passage now as if someone greater than Solomon has not come, right? That's what Jesus said of himself in Matthew 12:42. He is greater than Solomon. We've just seen Solomon's wealth and wisdom. Jesus Christ is greater than Solomon. He is greater than Solomon. Solomon couldn't bring us back to the tree of life. But what does Jesus Christ say? What does he say of himself in John 6:51? I am the living bread that came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread that I give for the life of the world is my flesh. John 6:51. So let me ask you here this morning, are you hungry? Are you thirsty? See, friends, food and drink in this world and work are by God's design meant to consistently remind us that we find satisfaction in God alone, even the giver of those things. And this only happens through the life that Jesus Christ gives. He gives. So look to Him. Look to Him. Feed on Him and be satisfied in Him today. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, this is